Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 1st, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I want to thank those of you who continue to support Talk Nerdy week after week and enable it to be free for everyone else to download. My top patrons this week include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Leonard Prince, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so, so, so very much. If you're interested in pledging your support, you can do so for as little as a dollar an episode by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. You can also show your support in other ways, like by visiting the Talk Nerdy store at talknerdymerch.com or by rating and reviewing wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and a whole host of other providers. All right, this week I am pleased to introduce Joanna Ebenstein. I had an incredible chat with her. She is so, so fascinating. So Joanna is the founder and creative director of Morbid Anatomy, and she's written several books. Her newest book is Anatomica, The Exquisite and Unsettling Art of Human Anatomy. It's a stunning and fascinating book. We dig into some pretty deep topics, and she is just really, really, really interesting. I know you guys are going to love this episode. Without any further ado, then, here she is, Joanna Ebenstein. Well, Joanna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so it's really rare that I get books sent from publishers that are as beautiful as the book that I received from your publisher. I'm always so excited when I get to chat with somebody who has a really kind of artistic yet scientific and just deeply creative vision. And I think that Anatomica hits the nail on the head when it comes to all three of those things.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's very nice to hear. I mean, one of the things I was really trying to say in the book is that art and science, which we now think of as completely separate categories, this was not always the case, or even that recently. You know, for many, many centuries, this was not the case, that art and science could coexist with religion quite effortlessly.
Right. And I mean, it's interesting to think that now that we live in a sort of internet age where we have digital imaging and we have all of these incredible tools that help us get closer and closer to, I don't know, realistic approximations of the human form, the human body, even beneath the barriers that we often, you know, see, like the skin or the bones that we can't see through. And we have these tools to help us see below, that there's still something about an artistic rendering, an anatomical drawing that shows us more than any imaging really can.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I have friends who are medical illustrators, including my co-author in the book, Marie Donheimer. And what she sees when she looks at these images and what my friend Eleanor Crook, who is an anatomical artist who has dissected many bodies, sees is the clarity with which they're presenting something that is not very clear in real life. Mm-hmm. And so there really isn't there is an importance to the art here in the sense that the human body does not just unfold and let us distinguish its different characteristics. You know, as they've described, it's more like a mess, right? And often a brown mess. And so these artists are really creating diagrams that allow medics and a general public to understand things that just looking at the object itself is not possible.
Oh, absolutely. And there's something to be said too about the fact that even if we were taking photographs back when some of these early anatomical drawings were first coming into focus, even if we had photography then, like you said, it wouldn't look like that because number one, it's a brown mess. And number two, generally speaking, these would be of cadavers. And cadavers look really different than living forms.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a really good point. And, you know, part of what has always interested me, and, you know, I should backtrack a little bit and say the place, you know, I've been interested in anatomical imagery since I was a little girl. My grandparents were doctors. They were also immigrants from Hitler's Vienna. So they'd both fled the Holocaust. So we had kind of the specter of death in our family, but we also had a more relaxed view of the body than I think a lot of American families do. And I would pore over their medical books when I was a kid, especially the ones with the transparencies. I'm sure you've seen those too, where you can see the rib cage and you pull that up and then you see the internal organs. And when I did my first book about them, I was trying to think of one way to kind of sum up everything that makes me fascinated by these images. And I chose this figure who's actually in Anatomica in illustrated form, which is called the Anatomical Venus. And so I did a book about it. I have to call it a her, not an it. And if you saw the image, you'd understand why. There are these wax models, life-size wax models of dissected or dissectable in eight layers, women with real human hair, with Venetian glass eyes. They were made in the 18th century in Florence, Italy, to teach a general public about anatomy. And everything that interests me about all of these anatomical illustrations, especially gathered together, is in that object as well. And, you know, what you were saying about the body looking different, you know, one of the things that medical illustrators and anatomical modelers were trying to do was erase that image of the cadaver, which had some negative connotations. And of course, before the days of x-rays and MRIs, that was essentially how we got our knowledge. So all of these illustrations you see up until a certain point, and these wax models as well, the knowledge that you're seeing represented there come from dead bodies. And that is really, really consciously being masked with beauty and with, you know, in the earlier anatomical illustrations, such as Vesalius, you see these animated skeletons or animated corpses kind of jolly on these beautiful landscapes. So there's a lot of effort to disguise the fact that dead, dirty, you know, somewhat taboo matter is where we're getting all of this knowledge.
You're so right. And even sometimes in these more, I guess you could say, surgical drawings where there are actual physicians standing around a corpse and doing a dissection, or maybe they're trying to imply that they're doing a live surgery, even the person lying there looking somewhat lifeless is still very kind of robust. There's an energy out of them. They're not flattened. They're not, you know, kind of subject to gravity. There's a lifelikeness to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what we have to remember when we look at these representations is going back to where we started the conversation. These were created by artists. And, you know, what I really wanted to do in this book, and when I was meeting with Lawrence King, and they were so wonderful to work with. We really saw eye to eye on a lot of things. And we decided early on about organizing the book. Did we want to organize it chronologically or by artist? And then we thought, no, it'd be much more interesting to organize it by body part, because then you can see really at a glance with a minimum of text that there is an artistic decision being made about how to represent them in each image, right? And that I really tried to, in the text, when I talked about each piece, I tried to accentuate the artist as much as the anatomist and as much as the author of the book, just to kind of bring to light something that I think gets lost a lot in these images.
Oh, absolutely. That these are intentional, that there is a choice that's being made by these creators, by these artists, to say, how can I represent this in such a way that it tells a story and that it's understandable to whomever my audience is, whether it be, you know, for an anatomy textbook or whether it be for a general museum display?
Absolutely. And not just that, but I would say also, how can I make this interesting and seductive for a general audience? And that's something that really surprised me when I delved into the history of anatomical illustration, is the fact that, you know, from the Renaissance on, this was really a popular science as much as a science for other doctors. So these beautiful elephantine volumes, meaning just very large volumes, sometimes life-size, that these anatomists were producing with artists, these books were they were quite expensive to produce, and they were as likely to be in a gentleman's cabinet of curiosities as in a doctor's study, right? So they were really considered objects of beauty, and also to be curious about the human body and to learn about it was seen during the Age of Enlightenment, especially, as kind of a good thing for a civilized member of society to do, a good way to learn about the body. And to learn about the body was to be a certain kind of rationalized citizen in the world. So there was a lot of, you know, what I really, really try to accentuate when I talk about this stuff is a lot of these images, again, were for a mass audience and not just for doctors and medical students.
I love that. And I have to point to the fact that, as you mentioned, when you were trying to kind of, you know, first plan this volume and determine how are we going to represent these things in a way that makes sense, in a way that feels organized, and you bandied about the idea of doing them chronologically, but then decided to do them by body part or by region, I guess you could say. I'm very pleased that you still gave this nod at the very beginning of the book to this timeline. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with timelines. I think they really help me organize my thinking in terms of, like, because we're so bad with history, it all kind of runs together. And it's so nice to be like, oh, we didn't even know that yet. Or, oh, okay, this, oh, by then we had a microscope. Okay, that's important.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And I should say my background is history. I studied intellectual history at college. And, you know, when we look, you know, the way that we're taught to look at the world through intellectual history is to look at the material culture that humanity has created, things they've written, films they've made, photographs, art, language, fonts, costumes, everything, as reflective of the time in which they were made. And that's definitely the ethos that I bring to this book. And so to me, you know, I found I had to create my own timeline and understand these images, right? And also just other things like, when was the lithograph created? Or, you know, when were these great artworks being produced? Or when was Voltaire writing? And seeing all of these things together, they start to click into place and make a whole lot of sense as historical artifacts and as documents of history that tell us something about the time and place in which they were made.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's important, too, that we reflect our present state against history over. I mean, you know, it's obviously so important for us to understand how we got to where we are today, why or how we know what we know. And even in terms of specifically anatomical art, I think we often think of anatomical art as a vestige from the past, but this is still a current practice, isn't it?
It is. And I would say that one thing that I often say to people, and I think it's so fascinating, you know, we include two images that are very, very similar to images that you would see today in medical books, which is kind of, I always call it the Gray's Anatomy, right? So Gray's Anatomy was, I think, the first edition. It has slightly different name, but it was like 1830s, if I'm not incorrect, something like that.
Oh, wow. So that's even older than I thought.
Yeah, it's older than you think, but I think it's kind of I see it as kind of the turning point, because still in the 19th century, you're getting some images that are fanciful or that have memento mori imagery. And I should back up and say that's another interest of mine, as anyone who knows my work knows, is art and death in general. And, you know, I do see these as if unconscious, meditations on what it means to have a body and to be mortal, that are being made by artists in conjunction with doctors. And a lot of the earlier books, you know, going back to Vesalius and then extending into the 1850s or 1840s, these books in These illustrations and books that were intended to teach about the human body and its anatomy also have memento mori imagery. So memento mori were objects that were created going back to, they were very popular in the Baroque era, but going back further. And these are objects that were intended to remind the viewer that they would die. And so they might take the form of a ring or a watch, something you'd keep on you at all times, or it might be a painting in your house. But the idea was, in a Christian context, that you wanted to be ready to meet your maker at any time. And so this was supposed to remind you to not sink into earthly pleasures and earthly pursuits, but to remember, you know, the hereafter and to make decisions accordingly. And these, some of these images in these medical atlases, these anatomical atlases, are using very, very strong memento mori imagery. And so there's a real, again, this kind of blurring of art, science, and religion that I think is super interesting. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really, really interesting, and I also tried to kind of pull out in the book just through how I talked about the history of how we looked at the body, is I think a lot of people think, and I think I did, honestly, until I started to delve really into the history of science, that science was always, as we now think of it, kind of mechanistic, and if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist, you know, and that is not at all the case. And there was a time when you could be equally scientific and believe that the human body was the expression of God, you know, and a peek into the mind of God. And so these images that we see or try to see as purely scientific, and thus find them bizarre when they have these things we consider extraneous today, right? Things like beauty, when a woman has a beautiful hairdo, for example, or where the skeleton is contemplating a skull. It's our new viewpoint that makes these seem so bizarre. There was no one at the time who was like, what the hell is this, right? It wouldn't have become a trope if that was the case. So to me, it's like a reflection of how much we've changed. And what I think is so interesting about Grey's Anatomy is we look at that and we say, oh, that's how the body should be represented. And to me, that really tells me, again, as someone who studied intellectual history, that this is invisible to us. This is another convention that we don't see as a convention because it's our convention. We haven't changed, right? So I think 100 years from now, people will look at our medical images and say, well, what does the fact that they did this say about them as a culture? We can't see that because it's the water we're swimming in. You know what I mean?
It's such an important point. I mean, it's obviously a much broader point that you're making about how our reality really is constructed by culture. And this idea that, yeah, we can't. I mean, I was reading a talk by Jean-Paul Sartre the other day, and one of the things that he talked about was this concept of suffering, and that the individual who is in suffering often can't think of the fact that the suffering is a temporary state because it's their only state. And we think about that often when we're very, very sick or when we're dealing with grief or loss. And it's almost like we cannot remember what it was like to not have grief or to not be ill. And we long for it and we yearn for it, but we almost cannot know it because the water that we're swimming in is colored by, you know, it's tinged by suffering or it's tinged by sickness. And that's almost like a microcosm of exactly what you're referring to, these longer cultural states that all people find themselves in collectively, that it's almost impossible to see beyond that horizon because every single aspect of our existence is colored by these constructs.
Absolutely. And, you know, to that effect, you know, one thing that I was thinking, I was looking over the book again today just to kind of prepare for our talk. And one of the things that I found super interesting doing this research, which I had not known before, is that the female body was actually, for many centuries, considered to be a defective copy of the male body. And so in anatomical atlases, you don't see the female body as normal anatomy. You see it where it's different from the male. You see it for, you know, reproductive organs or the breast that can produce milk. Otherwise, you do not see female bodies. Up until a certain point, that shifts, right? But to me, that's exactly talking about what you're saying, is it's an invisible belief structure that colors the material culture of its time that we can only see in retrospect, really.
And it's interesting, too, that even to this day, although you're right, there has been a big shift. And of course, we have fully kind of atlased out the female body at this point. There still are these, I don't know if you want to call them holdovers or different shades, different hues based on, you know, the constructs that exist within our culture today, which is still, you know, heavily kind of misogynistic and paternalistic, that I've mentioned this on the show before, but I feel like it bears repeating. I was at my old gym that I used to work out at like 2 years ago, because hello, coronavirus. But there are these anatomical charts on the wall of the musculoskeletal system. And no lie, the titles of the charts are the musculoskeletal system and the female musculoskeletal system, as if the male system is the normative system and the female is the other.
And that is so deep in the history that we're talking about. And, you know, I do feel like, you know, as, again, intellectual history is a frame through which we're always trying to kind of understand the water we're swimming in, to step outside of our current moment and see it as objectively as one can. And I do think you're absolutely right. I think misogyny and you know, the fact we live in a patriarchy is one of the most invisible waters that we swim in. It's so unspoken and deep that it's almost invisible. It's really hard even for us who are trying to make it out to see it, because it's such a given in every part of how we've been raised, you know? So it's really fascinating.
Absolutely. Oh gosh. And I love that you are able throughout this volume to, you know, to give us these little tastes, these historical tastes and these descriptors that not only tell the story through the words, although the words are, they're very thoughtful and they're not overwhelming on the page, but through this art that we're able to kind of see this story unfolding in front of us, that brings to light not just history and not just these temporal shifts in our perspectives, but also these conceptions of, I don't know, what kind of pointing back to something that you mentioned a minute ago, that the sort of story that's told has a strong memento mori, or at least a strong sort of death salience, death perspective story to it. And one of the ways, obviously, when we're talking about the human body, I think that becomes evoked in some ways quite naturally. But one of the ways that this is also told, and you do such a beautiful job in your book, is through images of health versus images of illness or pathology or, you know, different states.
Mm, mm. Well, thank you. I'm glad that came through, because, you know, we really tried to stick with anatomy versus pathology mostly. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, we wanted that suggestion there. And I think, you know, another thing that makes me think of is a theme that you see in anatomical illustration that you definitely see in the book, which maybe is what you're referring to, is there were kind of two schools of anatomical illustration at a certain point. They were like warring factions. And one of those factions was the idea of creating a composite, idealized, perfect body that never existed on a particular individual. So we see this, for example, in Albinus, who creates what he calls homo perfectus. You know, it's an enlightenment era idea of creating the perfect human through looking at hundreds of them, creating kind of the average, right? And making that as beautiful and simple as possible. And then you have other artists who are really fighting against that and making public claims against the efficacy of that, and instead doing what amount to portraits of cadavers that they're dissecting. And so you really get a sense of these different schools of thought about how best to instruct a general public and medical students about the body and its realities.
Oh, and that's, I mean, how important that, you know, I think that speaks to, again, this kind of larger cultural, this larger, very psychological and very evolutionarily human tendency to compare ourselves and to say, are we normal or are we abnormal? Are we healthy? Are we natural or are we aberrant? And what a disservice that often, I think, medical instruction or medical education has done, and even biomedical education. You know, I myself was a student of the natural sciences before I went into psychology and studied neuroscience and kind of worked as a neuroscientist for quite some time. And one of the things that I learned almost later, I almost learned it in retrospect, it was not part of my education, was that when we learn about these systems and these processes and even these just, you know, basic anatomical, you know, atlases, that this is a sort of like normal center of the normal curve. Like, it doesn't mean anybody is like this across the board. You know, somebody might have an extra bone there or an extra tendon here, or there might be, you know, these things in their body might be larger or smaller or stronger or weaker. And that's normal variation, but that's almost never spoken of.
Hmm. That's super interesting. And what that makes me think of is, it makes me think of Foucault and, you know, his kind of tracing. And I don't know, you probably know more about this history than I do. I've not thought about that before. But is that like when I think of Foucault, who kind of argued that this idea of like the watchful eye from the outside and this idea of trying to be normal is tied to the rise of the medical establishment. And that, you know, like you think, you know, another thing I really tried to kind of, I always try to talk about my work and I tried to hit the tone of in this book to a certain extent, is that the idea that we have now that science and medicine are our truth-giving devices, right? Is our, you know, what Jungians would say is our current myth that is invisible to us. Right. That it's, I mean, of course, I'm not at all diminishing science. I think science does incredible things and medicine, and I'm super grateful for it. But for example, science has not yet told us what happens when we die. We don't know. Right. So there, but it's doctors that we go to for this information now, where it used to be priests or shamans before that. Right. So there's something that's happening here, that I think when science becomes the lens through which we view everything, then we start to worry about what makes us normal and what makes us abnormal, right? Like, I wonder if that was as strong of an obsession in the Middle Ages before we had a scientific establishment obsessed, you know, I'd say the scientific establishment that got obsessed like in the 18th and early 19th century with what made us normal, with sexuality, with the body, you know. I don't know. It's very interesting to think about. I hadn't thought about it the way that you just said it, but I think that's super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and we see it through works like I recently had on the show. Actually, it's been a bit now, but I had Angela Saini on the show, who wrote two very important books, Inferior and Superior, about basically how the scientific and medical establishments really codified racism and sexism and made them normative, made them almost more socially acceptable, because, you know, this was coming from the establishment and saying, look, we did measurements and we know that there is a difference between the races, which of course now we know is like a you know, just a construct like anything else. And you're right. I think this kind of idea of science, unfortunately, carrying the weight of the world in a sort of modern logical positivistic era is very dangerous. And I'm somebody who comes from the skeptic community. And what I think sometimes one of the downfalls that I see amongst fellow skeptics is that they're so obsessively focused on the idea that science will answer every question. Because, of course, there's so many examples in our culture where the scientific explanation is being shirked or ignored. And so it becomes important to take up that cause. We just saw it with Dr. Fauci being interviewed by the press in his new role, saying, oh, my gosh, it's going to be evidence-based. I'm so excited. He's like dancing up there. And of course, that's important. Now, I mean, it's wholly important. And I understand why people have really pushed to take up that cause. I do the same thing. But when it becomes the only metric for how we see the world, and when it starts to, as you mentioned, attempt to answer questions that it is not capable of answering, that's when things become really dangerous.
I agree 1,000,000%. And, you know, it makes me think of when I was writing my first book about the anatomical Venus, I took a deep dive into the Age of Enlightenment to try to understand where these ideas come from. And when you look at the core Enlightenment texts, I can't remember which one it was exactly. I quote it in the book. It was a long time ago now, excuse me. But basically, I think it was the Critique of Pure Reason. the author was saying, he says right at the very beginning, there are certain things which reason will seek to answer, which it cannot. They had a humility. The Age of Enlightenment had the humility. It's the 19th century when this becomes a way of life. And I would really say a religion or a mythology that guides how we see truth. And I really think what this generation is about, I'm hoping, from what I've seen with kind of a rise in both supported science, but also in anomalous experiences that can't be explained by science. I'm hoping that we move from an, you know, this, I'm not making this up, this comes from the Jungian world as well, but rather than a no, but idea to a yes, and. So in other words, like I don't really understand why we're not at a stage where we can say religion and belief are wonderful and we should absolutely have magical amulets and charms to help us against COVID. And and we should also do everything that's scientifically possible to have both, right? And I think
right. But the problem is so often people choose one over the other and ignore
I know. And I think that's what I honestly just find really hard to understand, why we haven't moved to a point where we can embrace both of those ideas. And I think maybe there's something about the science of the mind and the body and how they're connected that could help there. You know, one of our most popular talks we ever had at Morbid Anatomy, we had this neuroscientist who gave the talk four times, and it was about placebos and nocebos. It was called Placebos, Nocebos, and Voodoo Medicine. And it was so provocative because basically, you know, this is a guy who leads a lab studying this stuff. This is not a new age person, you know, telling us that people can take a placebo, they can be told it's a placebo, and the placebo can still work. So there's an implication there about a mind-body connection. I feel like that, to me, seems like the path to embracing the amulet and the vaccine, you know?
It's interesting because it's also something that I've been grappling with more and more in my work in psychology. Because, you know, historically, I worked as a neuroscience researcher doing wet lab work with animals and kind of holding tightly to a more logical positivistic, to a more, you know, obviously evidence-based worldview, which I continue to hold on to, but a little bit more lightly, was easy in that context. And now that I'm working as a psychotherapist, I'm working on my PhD in clinical psych, and specifically the population that I work with is a population of individuals with cancer, some of whom are dying. And obviously the topics that we grapple with within the sessions and the important emotional experiences of my patients really do color the idea that, as you mentioned, there are certain things that are outside of the bounds of science, yet we turn to science for their answers. And so an example I might give, well, two, I guess, quickly, is that number one of the things that I often repeat to my patients is that we know a lot. When somebody is dying, there are a lot of, there's often suffering involved in the dying process, especially when it's slow, like happens with life-limiting illnesses. And we know how to palliate physical suffering very well. We have amazing drugs available to palliate pain, to palliate air hunger, to palliate nausea. But when it comes to what we'd refer to maybe as psychological pain, spiritual pain, emotional pain, we don't have those palliatives, yet we turn to medicine so often in that situation. And the great irony becomes the fact that, as you mentioned, there are so many questions about what happens when you actually die, that we end up coming up really short. So often I find that my patients reach out to their oncologists, or they are left without answers about the dying process because that field simply doesn't study that. That field simply is about trying to kill the cancer. It's not about trying to usher and foster the individual through a quote-unquote good death or a quote-unquote authentic death. And so they end up feeling so scared, alone, and the fear often comes from this, like, the dark corners where the unknown exists. And so often, just illuminating the process of death. What happens when you die? What actually happens when you stop taking nutrition? What actually happens when you choose to you know, stop the chemotherapy and allow the cancer to run its course is just this black box for so many people. And that's a big part of the work that we do together. And it's amazing how rare it is, or how I shouldn't say rare, but how long we wait to grapple with those questions. We really wait until they're right in front of our faces.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing work you're doing. And it makes me think about, you know, in my world, you know, I teach a class, which actually I was just saying, you should attend if you'd like.
I yes,
teach
please.
A class. You can come for free. I would love to have you. I think it would be, I mean it. It's a class about basically befriending death through making your own memento mori. And in that class, I get a lot of death doulas. And in fact, my boyfriend has just did a certificate to become a death doula. So have you heard of the death doulas? Do you know about this?
I have. It's amazing. And I think I want to train in that as well, so that I have that secondary perspective.
Yeah.
And also post-COVID, when I can finally be with my patients again in person, that would be, you know, an option that could be available to me, because I love the idea of doing hospice care work and working with people sort of in those final, in actual extremis, like, you know, towards the actual end.
It's such a beautiful thing to do, because as you point out, there's no support there. It's not even something people can talk about with their friends and family and loved ones, really. And in part, one of the things that got me into this line of work, or got me, really helped push me towards morbid anatomy, was my grandmother, who I mentioned earlier, who was a survivor from Hitler's Vienna. And when she was around 94, and her husband, who she'd been with since she was 19, had died a few years before. And she was like my favorite grandmother, like we were very close. And she would say to me over and over, she just said, you know what, I want to die. I'm ready to die. And there's no one I can say that to except you. And I was like, well, I really started to think about it. Well, why? Why can't you say, like, that's about the most powerful and important thing you could share with another human. And there's such a taboo in our culture that you're not allowed to talk about this. And so that really
people will literally respond and say, don't talk like that, mom or grandma.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to hear that. That's, oh no, you don't really, you don't mean
that's
it.
Morbid. Like, that's morbid.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
There's something that's so messed up to me about a culture where one is not allowed to talk about the most important rite of passage, if you want to talk about it that way, that happens to every single human that has ever lived and will happen to every other single human that lives now, unless we come up with a solution. So I think there's something very morbid about a culture that refuses to, that makes it impolite and stigmatizes talking about the most important transition that any of us will experience, that of course we're all curious about. And of course, defines a life, how you respond to it. You know, there's something really messed up with that.
I completely agree. I mean, the fact that it is like the ultimate taboo, but it's also the only real truism, right?
Yeah.
It's the one thing that we are all going to do at some point or another. And the fact that we just ignore it until the last possible minute, or just simply deny it. And you see it too in the deaths of cancer patients often. But of course, I think we could broaden that up to individuals who just fight so hard until the very end. And that's their authentic way of dying, of course. But from the outside watching, it's heart-wrenching to see somebody who just cannot accept, is unwilling to accept, and doesn't have that kind of peace and equanimity in those final stages. You know, I'm interested, there are a couple of different things were mentioned in this exchange of ours. And I think sometimes I have to remember I'm doing a podcast. It's not just a conversation. So maybe people who are listening would want a little more info. So maybe the first thing to touch on would be the death doula idea. And obviously I know that you're not a death doula, and so this isn't your, you know, prime area of expertise, but because your boyfriend has just trained in that, and because obviously you study and are quite interested in death, maybe you can speak to what that role is.
Yeah, I'll tell you my understanding, and you might be able to add to it. As I said, a lot of people in my classes are also death doulas. So a death doula, from what I understand, is like a midwife who helps someone not into life, but into death. And so, you know, for example, in the medieval times, during the Black Plague, there were these books that popped up called Ars Moriendi, or The Art of Dying. And basically, during the Black Plague, there was so much death that there weren't enough priests to help out. And priests were afraid, of course, of going to the bedside of the people. So before then, the idea of a good death was to have a priest come to your home and you'd have a final communion and all the final confession and all these other things. And when that can no longer be supported by the population, there's books that come out and there's some of the first mass produced books with the printing press. They were very popular and they were called Ars Moriendi. And I feel like in a way that's what's going on with death doulas. There's a gap of someone who can help you navigate what happens as you get sick and go into death, and then perhaps what happens next. But from what Brian, my boyfriend, tells me is there's a lot of really interesting things that are a part of this. You help the person to figure out their legacy and what they've done with their life and what they want to be remembered for and what their unfinished business is. And can that be resolved in some way? So it's kind of preparing someone for a good death, as I think it would have been seen in a way, not unlike the medieval period without the religious, you know, the religious connotation. And also, you know, one of the classes that I teach at Morbid Anatomy is about different approaches to the afterlife, the journey between the land of the living and the land of the dead, and the in-between from a variety of different religious traditions. And one of them is shamanism. And when we heard the shamanistic view, and of course, shamans are kind of the religion. There were shamans all around the world. It's a near universal, if not a universal, all around the world who have surprisingly similar different kinds of ceremonies and this and that. And one of the things that was most important in the shamanistic world is to be what is called a psychopomp. So a psychopomp is a guide. Yeah, isn't that a great word? A psychopomp is a guide for the soul from the land of the dead, land of the living to the land of the dead. Sometimes animals can be psychopomps. Gods can be psychopomps, like Mercury in ancient Greece was a psychopomp, or Rome. And so basically one of the most important roles of the shaman was to help the dying person to die well, as you said, right? To kind of finish their unfinished business, say their final goodbyes and resolve themselves, come to a resolution with their death. And also in a more spiritual culture, the idea was also to help them navigate from the land of the living to the land of the dead. And, you know, we know from like Buddhism and the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Egyptian Book of the Dead, those were also guides to navigating all of the kind of puzzling things that would happen along the way between the realms, right? So I kind of see death doulas as a very traditional role that once, you know, people used to die at home. So, you know, to backtrack a tiny bit more, in the Victorian era, I'm sorry, I'm a historian. This is how I look at the world. So it helps me to understand, right? So in the Victorian era, people didn't die in hospitals unless they were poor. They died at home surrounded by loved ones, not alone, surrounded by loved ones. This included the children. And that was what you would want. That was your ideal death. And now we die in a hospital most often, right? Not with our loved ones, well, especially now during COVID. So I think in a sense, what a death doula is doing is bringing back traditional ways without the religion. You know, I think there's still a spiritual element, but it's not as, I don't think you need a belief in an afterlife or any of these things in order to get something out of having a death doula. And I definitely would say after hearing Brian talk about it and hearing the people in my classes talk about it, I definitely want a death doula. I mean, as you said, there's a gap between this, you know, the services that hospitals and medicine provide are many, you know, they're helping with, as you said, oncology and all of these things, but helping someone to navigate psychologically this pivotal moment seems like an understatement, you know, like this very, very essential defining moment of your life that doesn't exist in our current medical worldview. And I feel like death doulas have come in to fill that gap.
And I'm so glad that they exist, and I want to see that role elevated because I think in some ways that is becoming my attempt. So I'm a fourth year in my PhD program, so I'm still navigating the training models. I'm still trying to squeeze as much out of, you know, becoming a PhD level psychologist. So a clinical psychologist who is in a scientist practitioner model, meaning that by the time I graduate, I will have done 1500 practicum hours. I will have done a full year internship and I will have written and defended a dissertation. So I will be kind of trained within both the practice, but also the theory of psychology. And I've been focusing almost from the beginning on death and dying. And it's been my kind of singular passion within my within my training, you know, but of course I'm learning all of the basics along the way as well. And I think that what I'm learning as I start to get into the weeds and as I start to actually get into the practice component is that there's not so much a place for me in a lot of institutions. For example, in hospice care, I can't get reimbursed. It's very rare for a hospice facility to reimburse somebody who has my credential, that it's almost like a quote overqualification. Not yet, I'm not there yet, but who would have the credential that I plan to get. And so there are some opportunities within hospital systems, there's some opportunities within private systems, but in many ways I've been grappling with this idea of what can I offer and how can I maybe develop a practice that works with death doulas, that works with social workers, that works with...
I love that idea.
Yeah, but that also brings in this license and this ethic that I have to answer to a board and that I have core kind of competencies that are required within my field that I like, you know? And so, I don't know, it's been an interesting thing to see how exactly as we were talking about before, culture has these normative views, these restrictions, these requirements that exist in the background. And when you start to navigate within these worlds, you're navigating within a cultural frame that is not sometimes very hospitable to these ideas. So you're pushing and pushing and pushing against the sort of norm, because the idea of death, as you said, is so taboo. It's uncomfortable for many, and people really do label you as being like a morbid weirdo when you talk about death all the time.
Yeah, believe me, I know. And that's, you know, that's the reason I call my project Morbid Anatomy, in part. It's because it was kind of an idea of reclaiming this word of morbid, because people called me morbid my whole life, of course, you know, and I used to say, yeah, I guess I'm morbid. And then at a certain point, I just started to think about it. I was like, okay, is it morbid to think about death, and why? You know, if everyone who has ever lived has died, and everyone who's alive today, barring a medical miracle, will also die, then why on earth would it be called morbid to talk about it? I began to think that it's actually morbid not to talk about it. And, you know, I really think there is something about almost like a childlike wish fulfillment about this idea that if we just don't talk about it, it won't happen to us. But in fact, it will, you know? So I really, really think the better thing to do is to face it and try and learn about it. And, you know, for me, one of the things that's really helped me is looking at historical attitudes about death and also seeing that people have lived on through this stuff. And I think there's a way to learn from the past. And, you know, again, the kind of bringing the memento mori back, I think there's a way in which we can take this idea that was created as part of a Christian tradition to encourage people to be more afraid, arguably, right? But use it as a tool of empowerment, you know, like to have an object that reminds you that you're going to die. So you can say, okay, if I'm going to die and I don't know when, if I died tomorrow, what would I regret? And that really helps you clarify your true values and live the life on earth that you want to before it's too late. That's what it's done for me thinking about death.
I completely agree. And I think in many ways, it's interesting because it's one of the things that I bring into the therapeutic space. It's not uncommon for me to talk about the metaphor of we all have a clock on the wall, and that clock is keeping time, and we all know one day it will stop, and none of us know when, but we all have one. And unfortunately, some of my patients are in the position where the clock is just simply more salient to them. It's bigger, it's brighter, it's louder, and they know that, you know, they don't know when. Nobody can know when. That's the crazy thing too. Like, even a physician can't say, you've probably got a week. It's just very hard to push to make those kinds of determinations, and every time we try, somebody does something insane and like it, you know, and ends up living 10 times longer or 10 times shorter, and it's just, you know, why those kinds of numbers really do become meaningless after a while. But that clock being so much more salient, so much brighter, so much louder, in a way helps us reflect on what can we do now? You know, I know that my end is coming. How can I live? My death is the way that I measure my life. The same way that I often talk about, you can't really know love without loss, and you can't really know joy without pain. Having that equal and opposite emotion or experience is what makes the other experience measurable and you know, brighter. And so this memento mori that you speak of, I'm interested that the course that you offer for people who might be interested in taking it, tell me a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So it's a 4-week class where I talk about historical attitudes towards death. And what we do is over the course of 4 weeks, each student uses the material, which is the lectures, but also a bunch of readings and screenings that I provide to kind of develop their own beliefs about death, their own myth, and to create an object or an artifact or a written piece or anything they want, any project that solidifies what they've learned. And we talk about it in class. So it's as much a art class as it really is a support group, I'd say. You know, I think people really, honestly, I think one of the most important things it has done, and I've been teaching it since April every month, so I've seen a lot of people, is it gives people a place where they can talk about these things safely with other people who share their interest and don't think it's morbid. So it's gotten very personal. It's, you know, some of the objects that people make are memorials to people they've lost, or, you know, this and that. There's a very, very strong therapeutic element, I'd say, like a group therapy element, but it's also about creating this object that then you keep with you to help you to, you know, basically the, I came up with the class when coronavirus hit, and I thought, you know, this is a historical moment. You know, we in the West have been mercifully spared having to face our mortality for a long time in any real strong way. And now that moment, there's a moment in which we're being invited to make a connection with death and to come to terms with it. Not everybody will, of course. Some people are not inclined that way and want to put their head deeper into the sand. And I have respect for that too. But in our community, a lot of people are curious and want to look at the darkness and to understand what it means to them so as not to be as afraid, I think. And I think that's really what the class does, if that makes sense.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Absolutely. I love that so much. And you know, the other thing that I was thinking that maybe we could spend some time clarifying is morbid anatomy itself. You know, what is this sort of, I don't know, project? Is that the right way to put it?
It's such a great question. I think I don't even know. And I've been doing it for over 10 years. So it's very amorphous as part of the problem. So morbid anatomy started as a blog. I was a visual artist that I still am a visual artist, among other things. I was doing a photography exhibition about medical museums. So for those of your listeners who have visited places like the Mütter Museum in Philadelphia, that's the most famous one. Have you visited that, Cara?
Obsessed. Yeah, I've been there like 5-6 times maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, I love it.
I love it too. I was obsessed with it. Someone gave me a calendar of it when I was in my early 20s, and I became obsessed and I took a pilgrimage there. And then I began to realize that there are museums like that all over Europe. And mainly through a book by a professor named Stephen Asma, who did a book that I highly recommend called Stuffed Animals and Pickled Heads.
I love that.
Yeah, it's great. And I think the subtitle is A Natural History of Natural History Museums, something like that. And it talks about kind of the roots of natural history museums as we know them today. So cabinets of curiosity, and then these collections of human specimens, abnormal and normal. And I just became obsessed reading about this. And I started to travel and photograph them. So in 2007, I did an exhibition of photos of medical museums around the world at the University of Alabama at Birmingham with a woman named Stephanie Rookus, who oversaw the project. And to prepare for that exhibition, I went to Europe on a photo expedition. And also I ended up, just because of the way it went, sitting down with all these curators at all these museums all around Europe and the United States. And all of them were so lovely and generous and gave me information. They gave me articles. They suggested books. So I basically created this blog as a way to organize all the research I was doing and as a way to start to sort through all these photos and figure out, how does this become an exhibition? What is it I want to say with it and all of this? And to my utter surprise, it was kind of just the right thing at the right time, I guess. The blog developed a cult audience almost immediately. It was not my intent. Really, it was not my intent that anyone else read it. It was really a tool, a research tool. And so I just kind of followed the river that started there. So it started as a blog, and then I had a bibliography on the blog, and people began to ask if they could access the books. And I brought them to my house, and then my then boyfriend was like, you can't invite strangers over to the house to look at books. So I got this, you know, miraculous, cheap studio space in a shared artist space called Proteus Gowanus in Brooklyn, New York. So I opened up the Morbid Anatomy Library. First, it was open by appointment, and then that became too much. So it was open every weekend, and then people started volunteering. And then we started a gallery and lecture space in basically an art studio that opened up next door, also in Proteus Gowanus, and that became Morbid Anatomy Presents. So it just kind of kept growing in this very organic way. And then I met a woman named Tracy Hurley Martin. She came to one of our events and at the space in Proteus Gowanus, and she loved the idea of Morbid Anatomy and thought it should be something bigger. So together, she and I created the Morbid Anatomy Museum. So Morbid Anatomy was a standalone museum for about 2 years in the Gowanus area of Brooklyn, New York. And unfortunately, as you probably know in your line of work, funding things like this are not easy. It's very hard to fund things that, quote unquote, and this was in our statement, fall between the cracks. We actually fell between the cracks of funding. So until then, though, we did a bunch of really wonderful exhibitions. We had a great community. It was very successful in every way, but financially. So then the museum ended and we kind of went mobile. So at that point, I started working. I created a business with my colleague, Leticia Barbier, who started as a volunteer for me back at the Morbid Anatomy Library. And so together we run Morbid Anatomy Now, which is based on a website, morbidanatomy.org, and we offer classes and lectures. We do books like Anatomica. What else do we do? We do exhibitions and pop-ups. We produced an exhibition at the Mütter Museum on Victorian hair art. We did exhibitions at Greenwood Cemetery, which is a beautiful historical cemetery in Brooklyn, New York, with Harry Bile. And what else do we do? We do so many things that it's very, so what are we? I mean, Leticia once called us an organization without walls. That's kind of what it feels like we are, but it's unclear what to call what we do. We do lots of things.
I love that. Is there a way for individuals who are interested in keeping up with all these lots of things is there a place they can subscribe or follow online or tell us
absolutely.
About it.
You can follow us on Instagram. We're very active on Instagram and Facebook. Or you can sign up for our mailing list, which is at our website, morbidanatomy.org.
Very cool. Very cool. And so now I figure, because we're kind of coming towards the end, that we should circle back to Anatomica and maybe a couple of more conversations about this before I pose my final two questions, which I do with all of my guests. I'm just flipping through as we've been talking and again, appreciating just the sort of depth, but also the breadth of this volume. And one of the things that sticks out to me, maybe I should say, and perhaps that's because we've long held this very sort of European Western view, is the inclusion of Asian influence, kind of ancient Asian influence, and the fact that you've made sure to provide some more, I don't know, are they more ancient? Are they contemporary with some of the Western drawings? They're just, the contrast is so stark between the Western styles and the Asian styles.
Yes, I was thrilled to be able to include those. And here I have to give a hat tip to the Welcome Collection. I don't know if any of your listeners, have you heard of the Welcome Collection, Carol?
Yeah, in the UK, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the Welcome Collection was a huge, huge part of this book. Basically, they have an online image archive, which I highly recommend. Just go to welcomeimages.org, if you look up Welcome Images, you'll find it. I can't remember exactly, but they did
Welcome with two L's, right?
Oh, yes, good point.
Yeah, because it's like a person's name.
yes, it's a pharmaceutical magnate named Henry Welcome is what it's named after. And he's amazing. He was like, I call him the William Randolph Hearst of death and medicine. He was a hugely rich man, and he just collected hugely and widely. Up until his death, when he died, he had over 1 million objects, some in crates that had never been opened. It looks just like, remember the last scene in Citizen Kane where we see the warehouse with all of those objects? That's what it's like, but they're all medical objects or things related to health and medicine and death. And so basically his collection is incredible. The Wellcome Collection works with that collection. And they have very, very generously digitized many, many images in their collection and make them available free of charge. And so we were able to use a huge amount of those images, including some of the Eastern ones. And I did not know much about Eastern ideas until I worked on the book. I had to learn about it. And it's so interesting because until Western ideas came in the 18th century through Western publications, they had a totally different system of medicine that was a lot like our humoral tradition. So until scientific medicine, as we now think of it, there was this idea of the humors, which stretches back to ancient Rome, I believe, ancient Greece or Rome, I always forget, Galen. And this idea that unhealthiness came from an imbalance of these four systems in our body, which were yellow bile, black bile. Oh, God.
It was like the blood, yellow bile, black bile. I'm going to look it up.
It's been a while since I wrote the book, but it was like, blood.
Blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm.
That's it. Blood. You go. And so basically, for example, if you were melancholy, if you had a melancholic disposition, which we would say now depressive, then you had too much black bile in your system. And so there were all these systems for treating people that had to do with balancing those humors. But what is so interesting to me is that the Eastern way of looking at the body is very similar to the humoral traditions. Right? They're both very holistic. And in both of them, there's correspondences between the different systems in the body and the different parts in the body and the greater cosmos. So astrological signs, for example, different stars, different elements such as, water, fire, air. So they're quite similar in this way. And neither of these traditions were about dissection, right? And singling out things from their parts. They're about how things fit together and about how to create balance. And there are also in the Eastern tradition, very poetic names, which I tried to include whenever I could, because they're so fanciful and lovely and so different from the medicine we know. So yeah, going back to one of the main points we're talking about, I really, really wanted to get across in this book in a very simple way with few words, just that, again, the way we look at the body now as mechanistic and scientific and, Latin terminology is not inevitable. It wasn't always how it was. It's just how we look at it now. There were many, many other systems for understanding the body for many, many centuries. And ours has not been around that long, comparatively speaking.
Oh, I love that. I think that really does put like a nice bow. It sort of circles us back all the way to what we were talking about at the beginning. So, Joanna, I was hoping that before we say our adieus, that I could ask you two pretty big picture questions that I ask all of my guests on the show as we close the interview.
Okay, sure.
All right. So I want you to think about the future, and you can do that in whatever context is relevant to you. Of course, there is a lot going on in the world right now, but we also all have our own personal journeys and stories. So the first question is kind of the bummer one, and that is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, that you're most concerned about, maybe even pessimistic, a bit, I don't know, cynical about? What are you sort of like, ugh? And then on the flip side of that, what is the thing that is absolutely keeping you going? What are you optimistic about and really authentically looking forward to?
I think what I would say, I'm going to start with optimism because that's my way. I think I'm an optimistic person ultimately. And what I am optimistic about, going back to this idea of bridging, right, of yes, and as opposed to no, but, right? That I feel that what I'm seeing with the shifts in culture, the increasing inclusion of other viewpoints, the increasing equality for women and people of color, and the rise of a intelligent and balanced interest in anomalous, non-scientifically verifiable phenomenon, is that we will find a place where the kind of mechanistic, destructive, I would say patriarchal worldview we have is tempered by, is not destroyed, because there's many good things. I'm not saying we should throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there's a, you know, maybe a feminization or bringing in of some softer, more human elements to temper what I think has been a very brutal culture for so many, including disadvantaged people, but not just, you know, I think men suffer from it, women suffer from it. It's a very toxic culture, this advanced capitalism that we live in. And I would like, what I'm seeing with all of these tendencies is that there's a change happening there. What keeps me up at night, the pessimism, is that I think there's a lot of people that don't share those values for whom these changes are threatening instead of encouraging, and that they will fight hard to keep the world as it was.
Right. Yeah. That there are people who are just really gripping, just very much gripping, and really obviously want to maintain these structures because these structures privilege them and they help them feel a sense of importance or power, or, you know, however we want to define it.
And I think it goes back to what we were talking about with death too, to bring it full circle, right? I think this new kind of generational shift I'm seeing in the culture are the ones, I think, who are tied in with wanting to be death doulas or being interested in death and are open and curious about the world. And I think this hunkering down goes with a fear of death and a denial of death. So I think those things are related. But I do see some really positive changes, and I am hopeful. And I guess the other really big thing that's really hard to wrap one's head around is the environmental issues and the environmental degradation. I don't really see a way forward, but I am hopeful that our new president, I can already see that he's making really good decisions, and I'm hopeful, but I'm not sure I'm optimistic about the future of the world as it is now.
Yeah. And it's interesting how that, even that conception, I still think maps back to this idea of kind of the individual death, and can be broadened out metaphorically to sort of the death of biodiversity, the death of the planet, the death of this sort of self-imposed destruction and this eschatological sort of grand end.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately, these things are, for all intents and purposes, and in many ways, one and the same. So,
yeah, that's very well said.
Yeah. Gosh, Joanna, this has been such a fascinating, such a thrilling conversation. And I know, you guys, that it's really hard when we use an audio medium to really describe the beauty and the power of a visual format like Joanna's book. So I really highly, highly recommend everybody go out and grab a copy of Anatomica, The Exquisite and Unsettling Art of Human Anatomy by Joanna Ebenstein. Joanna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure. And I'm so glad you're enjoying the book. As you can tell, I mean, this is a real labor of love for me. I've been looking at this material for 20 years now to get to do. It was such a privilege to get to put all of them together and present them to people. So it means so much to me that you're enjoying it as much as you are.
Oh, I'm so glad. And everybody listening, I want to thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.